Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, retired ambassador and immigration attorney George Bruno, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss immigration reform, as well as the ongoing reconciliation process in Congress, which also includes COVID-19 relief. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for a CQ roll call is reporting that the House Budget Committee moved a roughly $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill closer to the House floor this Monday. But several procedural steps remain before what's likely to be a razor-thin floor vote late this week or over the weekend. The budget panel, by law, can't make changes to the draft reconciliation bill, but it nonetheless has the job of packaging together the recommendations from numerous House panels that approved their legislative proposals the week of February 8th. The Rules Committee will meet later this week to make substantive changes, including incorporating pieces from three panels that didn't mark up their portions separately. The Rules Committee is expected to add offsets to the bill, which is currently slightly above its $1.89 trillion limit in the budget. It's also possible Rules will make other changes designed to make sure the legislation complies with budget rules in the Senate. The Senate parliamentarian is expected to decide this week whether a provision to more than double the federal minimum wage can remain in the bill without violating reconciliation rules. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join me to discuss the latest in the reconciliation process and COVID-19 relief. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Tori Gorman. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, and Tori is Concord's Policy Director, both regular contributors on the show. Welcome back, Bob and Tori.
Thank you, Chase.
Good morning, Chase.
Good morning. Pleasure to have you both on the program, and we're going to discuss a couple different topics that are somehow intertwined. One is getting an update on the reconciliation process, as well as an update on COVID-19 relief, which is happens to be using the reconciliation process as the vehicle to get it across the finish line. And that's my opening question for you, Tori. Have we just given up on a non-reconciliation process for any COVID relief right now?
Yes. Short answer, yes. I mean, there may be some Republicans that end up voting for the reconciliation bill to make it bipartisan, maybe. But yes, we've absolutely given up on a 60 vote process. We will be using the reconciliation process to pass the next COVID relief bill.
Is that a process that we're going to hear a lot about in the coming months or year? I mean, is it something that Democrats can keep going back to, or is there a limit to that process?
So this answer is going to be a little bit longer than the one I just gave you.
More than one word.
The Congressional Budget Act allows four different types of reconciliation bills. But depending upon the type of reconciliation instruction that you give to committees, that can be construed as using up two of those in one shit. So they can issue revenue instructions, spending instructions, and debt limit instructions. But if you issue a deficit instruction, that's construed as using up spending and revenue. So, and then you're allowed, one budget resolution per fiscal year. So the budget resolution they're working off of and the reconciliation instruction the House is working off of right now has to deal with fiscal 21. The committees were issued deficit instructions. So they're pretty much one and done at this point with that particular budget resolution. Now, soon to come down the pike in late spring is going to be the fiscal 22 budget resolution. And in that, they'll be able to issue a whole new set of reconciliation instructions. And it'll be interesting to see what they use, given that debt limit is going to be an issue towards the end of the summer. So they might issue deficit instructions to a bunch of committees, but Ways and Means and Finance may get deficit instructions and a debt limit instruction. And they can put that debt limit in with everything else, or they can issue it as a separate reconciliation bill. So that would mean two reconciliation bills out of the 22 budget resolution. I wouldn't think that they put it into. I think that even if they do a debt limit instruction, it's such a hot potato, they would roll it in with everything else. But I don't even anticipate a debt limit instruction there. So short answer to paraphrase what I'm just
loaded
saying
question.
you've got an opportunity for one more reconciliation bill later this year.
Got it. And I want to talk about where this bill is in just a second, but I want to come back to you, Bob. We've talked in the past on the show about this bipartisan group in the Senate and opportunities for them to have influence. If we're looking at other opportunities for reconciliation to be used, which in effect could sidestep that group, where do you see opportunities moving forward that they could have a say or push forward bipartisan reform on any key legislation?
Well, keep in mind that the Senate is evenly divided, and that means that any senator, in effect, has a veto power over the bill. So if a group can have influence, or even one senator, but more likely that a group could simply by withholding their support, even for a reconciliation bill, exert leverage. Now, that might not happen. Probably is not going to happen. I'm not entirely sure, but it probably won't happen in a big way on this COVID bill. Maybe they may have some leverage, but it looks like the Senate may take the House bill and just put it on the Senate floor, negotiating in advance with the House on any changes they might want to make, what's called pre-conferencing, and then pass it directly on the Senate floor without it going through the committees and the Senate, and then sending it back over to the House, which would already have approved changes that the Senate wanted to make. And so, there's, aside from sort of a nuclear option where a couple of senators on the Democratic side would stand in the way of the entire thing going through, and the unlikely scenario that you'd bring across a couple of Republicans, it probably there's not a whole lot of leverage that could be exerted this time. I think that there's more that can be done going forward with the next bill, which is the big one, the president's. But you thought this is the big bill?
No. This one was big.
this is a warm up.
This is the preamble to the big deal.
Exactly. This is an emergency supplemental to the $900 billion bill from December. What really is lurking in the background is the Biden budget, the Build Back Better program, which is going to be a lot bigger, call for a lot more deficit spending. We'll probably have some tax increase proposals in it to pay for some of it. It's big, it's huge, it's controversial. I think the bipartisan group of the senators can, if I were sort of giving strategic advice, it would be to really maybe save your ammunition for that one. They banded together and had a big effect on they really jump-started and had a big effect on the December COVID relief bill. And I think they could have a really, really important effect on the budget, the 2022 budget that Tory mentioned.
So, Tory, we've talked in the past about reconciliation and how detailed and intricate of a process it can be, and things being overweight and the Byrd rule and things I'm just totally going to muck up by trying to describe. And I'm curious, we talked, or there's been a lot of talk about the minimum wage increase right. proposed in this bill and whether that's going to cause it to lose privilege in the Senate or be birded. And again, I'm describing things poorly, but have you heard anything new on whether something like that's going to get kicked in the Senate, or to Bob's point, maybe someone goes nuclear and decides they won't vote against the package because that's in there?
So the latest I've heard is that the Senate parliamentarian is supposed to issue her opinion, her guidance on the minimum wage on Wednesday. Now that's not something that's made public. It's an email literally that she sends to the relevant committees, but I'm assuming that the media will get to committee staffers or members that are in receipt of that and get her opinion and her say. If I were a betting person, I would expect her to say that it's budgetary, but merely incidental, hence birdable. I don't think she'll say that it threatens privilege. And then at that point, Bernie Sanders is left with a decision. Does he leave the matter in his substitute amendment in the Senate and force someone to step up to the plate and raise a point of order against it? Or does he leave it out because he knows that people like Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema don't want it in there? And, you know, I'm not sure they want to be in a position of raising a point of order against it. And I'm sure they don't want to be in a position of having to vote no on the overall reconciliation bill. So Majority Leader Schumer in the Senate is going to have to sit down and have a conversation with Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema after the parliamentarian issues her guidance and say, okay, guys, this is how we're going to move forward on this issue.
Are you hearing any rumblings that leadership might try to overrule the parliamentarian if what she says is counter to what they want?
I haven't heard anything about that, and I wouldn't expect to either. I think something like that they would really keep under wraps. And that's a scenario that I equate with, you know, emergency break glass. So I think if they were to pursue something like that, it would be because Schumer has been unable to create some sort of compromise, negotiate some sort of compromise between Bernie Sanders, Manchin, and Sinema.
We've sort of talked about where things are or where they could be in bits and pieces, but can you kind of lay out where we are in terms of potential timeline? If everything went exactly as leadership in the Democratic Party wants right now, where would the finish line be and how do we get there?
Sure. So right now, the committees in the House have finished their products, or at least 9 of the 12. There are still 3 titles missing that are expected to be inserted, probably at rules. The individual reconciliation recommendations from the committees that received instructions have been sent to the Budget Committee. The Budget Committee met yesterday to report out the, quote, stitched up version of the reconciliation bill. So the next step is rules, House Rules Committee. House Rules will decide whether or not, first of all, what kind of rule will be used to guide debate in the House on the matter. And then if amendments are in order, which amendments? And I would imagine that Senate rules themselves will have an amendment in order based on conversations between the House parliamentarian and the Senate parliamentarian as to what really needs to be jettisoned from the House bill, if anything, in order to maintain privilege in the Senate. And then from there, the House is expecting to vote on the reconciliation bill towards the end of this week. I've heard that the calendar is expected to take sort of like Friday, Saturday, perhaps. I mean, I think they're trying to get this done Thursday, Friday, so that members can go home. And members hate working on the weekends, just like every other American. But I think the current thinking is that they'll probably be in session working on through the reconciliation bill on Friday and Saturday of this week. Then it gets sent over to the Senate. Once it's over in the Senate, it's got to go through a pretty thorough birdbath with the Senate parliamentarian and opposing counsels from both parties. That can take a while. Now, you can still process the bill simultaneously while these conversations are happening in chambers off the floor. Things don't really come to a head until you get to the Votorama aspect of the Byrd rule. But once the bill hits the floor over the Senate and it's up for consideration, they've got 20 hours of debate. Then they hit Votorama, and then Once members are exhausted with Voterama, they vote. So potentially this could get done, not by the end of this week, but the end of next week. But I just don't think it's going to move that fast. You've got other things on the docket in the Senate, including nominations. It's going to be a close call as to whether or not this bill actually gets finished by mid-March, as Democrats hope.
It almost seems like it would be quicker if you had a bipartisan bill with 60 votes of support in the Senate.
Some have suggested that.
I know. And so, Bob, I want to come back to you. I know the Congressional Budget Office, I think, has scored some aspects, or maybe this entire package. Can you give an overview of what their assessment was on the implications or impact of this bill?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically in line with the $1.9 trillion that was the target. They'll have to do a little bit of trimming. What strikes me about the bill is that it's relatively backloaded for something that's supposed to be a short-term emergency. Most of the spending does take place quickly, 2021, which is what you want. But it's only about two-thirds, a little less, 63-some percent of the outlays would take place this year, which struck me as not a high percentage of something. You know, we talk about timely, targeted, and temporary, and this would indicate that it may not be all timely. It certainly isn't all targeted, and it may not be temporary, some parts of it anyway. So, I worry about those things. Parts of it are you clearly need to do right away. The extending the unemployment benefits is something, as Tory mentioned, runs out in mid-March. So you want to get that done, and there's still an employment problem. You want to do everything you can to get the money out the door for vaccine distribution, acquisition, administration. But some of the stuff is, a lot of the money for schools, for example. There's a big debate about school reopening and what they need. A lot of the money in this bill wouldn't take place until next year and the year after, which makes you wonder what it has to do with opening schools this year. And there's a huge expansion of the child tax credit that wouldn't go into effect until this summer, when the economy is projected to really be hitting its stride, if not booming. So I it's not so much questioning the total size and saying, oh, we can't afford this. Maybe we could afford it. The question is, where is it? How quickly is it being spent, and is it being properly targeted, or is the emergency atmosphere being used as a screen to enact some permanent changes in the budget because this is a convenient vehicle for doing it?
Well, and that was going to be my question. Is this more a strategy to sneak some things in there that they might want to do with later reconciliation bills but might not have the space for it in that particular bill, and this is an opportunity to do that? And Tori, might be able to.
It would not be the first time that sort of thing had happened, Chase. It's the
famous Rahm Emanuel quote: "You never let a crisis go to waste."
Exactly. You've got a process now. You've got a reconciliation bill. It's a big push emergency. So whenever the president or the vice president is out promoting this, or Janet Yellen, or any of the top economic people, it's, we got to do this now. We got to do this now. It's an emergency. It's an emergency. People are suffering. And we're in a fight for time with the vaccine. All of that is true in the sense of, if you think of it as a timely, targeted, and temporary thing. But you start looking through the details of that $1.9 trillion bill, some of it isn't even supposed to pay out until 2022. I said, over a third of it. The outlays don't happen until 2022, 2023. And so with that stuff, is not necessarily something that has to be done right now. It would be better done in the regular budget, which is coming up. Because in the regular budget process, that's where you can evaluate new programs, you can make appropriate trade-offs. That's the right place to do that. So why would you want to stuff a bill, an emergency bill? Because it's very likely to go through. And, you know, if you can get a policy, a program into it that you want and not wait for the regular budget, people on both sides of the aisle have been known to do that.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out your comment, though, you know, about how most of the outlays, but not all of the outlays are in there. So if 60% of the outlays are in the first year, and the purpose of this legislation is to provide relief right now, that suggests that the size of this bill should be anywhere between $1.1 and $1.2 trillion. And there were rumors at the beginning of this process. I mean, I realize that the Republicans in the Senate, the 10 Republicans, put forward a bill that was about $600 billion. But you know, the rumor, the behind the curtain rumor was they could probably accept something up to $1 trillion. So if they had really kept this bill, you know, focused on relief that we could provide immediately right now, and really targeted, for example, the rebates. The recovery rebates at individuals and families, households that really need it. It's quite possible that we could have created a bipartisan piece of legislation right around $1 trillion and would not have needed to go through this partisan exercise. So I see that as just a really big missed opportunity.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of economic analysis too that focuses around that $1 trillion figure as perhaps being a more realistic or maybe a more appropriate would be the right word.
Sweet spot.
More appropriate, mm-hmm. Yeah, target. Including, I recall a discussion that I, a webinar that I was listening to that involved Paul Krugman and Larry Summers, and they were going back and forth about the size of this. And, you know, I think Krugman sort of said off the top of his head $1 trillion sounded about right to him, but if you could do $1.9 trillion, why not? And I think that's been the attitude.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman discuss the latest in the reconciliation process and COVID relief and what's next. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Tori.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
Up next, Bob will be back and we'll be joined by Ambassador and Immigration Attorney George Bruno to discuss immigration proposals and potential reforms. Back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Ambassador George Bruno and Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well, he's a regular contributor on the show and the executive director of the Concord Coalition. Ambassador Bruno was appointed U.S. Ambassador to Belize by then-President Clinton in 1994. From 98 to 2001, he was senior executive in the Pentagon office responsible for transferring the Panama Canal to Panamanian control. He's managing director of USA Group International, co-director of University of New Hampshire Partners for Peace, and practices immigration law in Manchester, New Hampshire. He began his career as a volunteer aide to the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy. He worked as a volunteer lawyer in Jackson, Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement and became an anti-poverty storefront lawyer in Newark, New Jersey, arriving during the civil disturbances in 1969. At age 29, he successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court to achieve a landmark decision protecting Social Security benefits from creditors. He was also the first director of the New Hampshire Legal Assistance and was twice elected as the chairman of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. Welcome to Facing the Future, Ambassador Bruno, and welcome back, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chase.
Pleasure to have you both on the program, and we're talking about a very far-reaching, broad but important topic, and that is immigration. What do you think the status of our immigration system is right now, and where do you think some key areas of reform need to take place?
Our immigration system is in dire need of repair. Under the Trump administration, it went into a nosedive. It became very destructive. The United States became a country that not only was going after illegal aliens, if you want to call them that, undocumented persons in the United States, but also cutting back on legal immigration. We stopped taking asylum applications. We reduced our refugee intake from 85,000 down to 15,000 per year under the Trump administration. There's a lot of work to be done to repair the immigration system in the United States. It's a debate that's been going on for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years. We don't seem to have a national consensus as to how our immigration system should be organized.
And I appreciate the summary there, Ambassador. And I want to set aside, at least for the time being, the discussion on illegal immigration and focus more on legal immigration for a few minutes. And my next question, how has legal immigration been affected in recent years? Are we taking in fewer visa holders? You know, how has the workforce been impacted, if at all, in any changes in immigration policy there?
Yeah, well, the workforce has been greatly affected. There was a headline in New Hampshire statewide newspaper just this week that said business is feeling the pinch of the absence of foreign workers. What is a good immigration system supposed to do? First, it is supposed to unify families. Second, it is supposed to bolster our economy. And how does it do that? By bringing in, admitting students, promoting investment, bringing in skilled workers to fill the empty spaces, the vacuums in our workforce. It's supposed to provide a refuge for people in war-torn countries where they can live in safety. So these are some of the purposes of our system, and in each of those, immigration seems to have broken down. The Trump administration spent a lot of energy trying to prevent people from coming into the country rather than developing a smart immigration system to promote the goals of an immigration system that works.
Well, you know, from the Concord Coalition perspective, from an economic perspective, Bob, what do you think some of the goals should be for immigration and immigration reform when it comes to legal immigration, at least that part of the conversation for now? Do you agree with Ambassador Bruno? Are there additional things we should be considering?
No, I very much agree with Ambassador Bruno. I think we put out a immigration proposal. It was actually written by Doug Holtz-Eakin, former CBO director and president of the American Action Forum. What we requested was, could you write a paper about immigration as a strategy for economic growth? So let me focus on that part of it, because we didn't deal with border issues. We didn't deal with the undocumented workers who are here. What we wanted to look at was what the legal immigration system was and could it be used as a strategy for economic growth? And we thought very much that it could. And so basically what we suggested was, let's not worry about caps on immigration. We need workers. I mean, that's the basic economic need, is that our workforce is growth. Workforce growth is declining sharply. This leads to a slowing trend of economic growth. If you look at all of the projections, economic growth is projected to slow considerably. I mean, there's a little bit of a bump now as we're recovering from the pandemic, but all of the, whether you go out 10 years or even further, shows economic growth, trend economic growth just declining. And a very large part of that, most of that, is due to declining workforce growth. So we have a need for more workers in this country. And that gives us an opportunity to use the immigration system to bring in skilled workers, people who could help make this economy grow better, entrepreneurs. As George said in the newspaper he held up, you know, there are businesses that need workers from abroad to help to help fill vacancies. We also it's not just high tech, high skill workers and that we need. We need low skill workers as well. And so our plan offered an opportunity based on a point system for legal immigrants to come to the United States, and it also offered a path for low skill workers that came here. And could establish a work history and after a while could apply for permanent residence and eventually for citizenship. So those are, I think, you know, one of the things that we should be thinking about in terms of the immigration system is how it can be used to fill a real void in economic growth.
Yeah, and that's true. And the point system is used in Canada, it's used in Australia and several European countries. But what is happening is that in the United States, we have an aging workforce. We have an absence of skilled workers to fill jobs. And so all of this affects the economy. And the Trump administration spent an awful lot of time trying to slow down immigration and indeed stop immigration. For example, one of the rules that it created was if you are an H-1B, which applicant, which is the special visa used by high-tech companies, and you were fortunate enough to get one of those, your spouse would typically be permitted to work also and contribute to the family income and to support the children that came with the family. The Trump administration cut that out. Another thing that it did in creating citizenships made it harder for people to naturalize by making the questions more complicated and increased in number. So all these little regulations and executive actions numbering more than 1,400 individual impediments that the Trump administration created represents a challenge for the Biden administration to kind of discover what these impediments are and to try to ameliorate them.
There's been a lot of talk about the Biden administration putting a proposal out there. Bob, you mentioned the one that we worked with on with AAF back in 2019. But before I get to that, I did have a more specific question for you, Ambassador. And I'm wondering, we talked about the need in the workforce for more immigration. And Bob, we've talked ad nauseum in the past about the Shape of Things to Come series with, you know, dwindling fertility rates, lower workforce growth, you know, so we've laid out the case that there's a need for at least some increase in immigration. And I'm wondering, Ambassador, if you could give maybe a real life example without obviously violating, you know, attorney-client privilege of a type of business in New Hampshire that has needed an increase in immigration to support their workforce.
First of all, our Social Security and Medicare system in the United States depends, of course, on the contributions of workers. And with an aging workforce and those trust funds becoming imperiled, immigrants are able to contribute and support those citizens that are aging. And number two, here are some interesting things to note during COVID. The U.S. health system is greatly dependent upon our immigration system. And so it's important for us to remember 20% of all pharmacists have been born outside the United States. 25% of all dentists in the United States were born outside. And 29% of all doctors in the United States were born abroad. So our healthcare system is heavily dependent upon our immigration system. And if you wonder why some people can't get their COVID shots right now, it's because the healthcare system in the United States is inadequately staffed and not prepared to deal with the emergency that's in front of us.
All right. So now I'm going to pivot back to proposals. I mentioned that the Biden administration put a proposal out there. Ambassador, can you maybe summarize some of the highlights of that plan and what its focus is?
The Biden administration has taken a three-pronged approach with executive actions, regulatory changes, and legislative proposals. And for example, it increases the number of refugees coming into the United States. The United States takes its place once again in welcoming people from war-torn countries and countries that have suffered natural disasters. Very important, DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The Biden administration has strengthened that program and extended it for a number four years. It has created a proposal of a path for citizenship for people that have temporary protective status in the United States and also DACA, giving them green cards immediately. It's created a proposal for a path for citizenship for undocumented persons living in the United States over an 8-year period. So, these are some of the things that that the Biden administration is doing and that are before Congress right now.
So, Bob, I want to bring you back into this conversation. And with regard to the Biden proposal, you mentioned one of the focuses of the 2019 proposal that we helped put out, we had an economic growth focus. Does the Biden proposal take any kind of angle there, or is economic growth sort of viewed as incidental to what this plan proposes?
No, I think they're very much aware of it as part of an economic growth strategy. It's not solely focused on that. It's more focused on solving some immediate problems, which is understandable because we were putting out a long-term perspective. And the Biden administration, and we acknowledged in the paper that that we were not dealing with these short-term issues because we wanted to have a vision for the legal immigration system and have the focus be on that. The Biden administration doesn't have that luxury because they're coming in and the president has some very important short-term issues to deal with, DACA being one of them. What do you do about unwinding the border policies from the last administration that have resulted in lots of people packed into the border on the Mexican side? And it's a question of how do you resolve that problem, judging asylum claims and, without encouraging people to flood to the border. So they have some real problems, right, initially that they have to deal with. But I don't think that it is not as focused on a sort of like a point system for using the immigration system specifically to enhance economic growth. They have made the case that more immigrants or pathway to citizenship for people that are already here would improve economic growth.
Yeah, it's kind of a repair and recovery operation. It is doing a number of things in dealing with the border. First of all, it has plans for enhanced security along the border, different from a wall, using satellite technology, using infrared cameras, and trying to promote security by using high-tech techniques. It is also proposed a package of $4 billion of aid to Central American countries to help ameliorate some of the conditions in those countries that would cause people to want to leave their homes. It's also is setting up regional asylum intake centers in various countries so that people don't have to join caravans and travel to all the way north to the United States. It's restarted the MPP hearings on the border. It recently allowed 25,000 refugees into the United States from people who have had been encamped on the border for 25 years. And it's also recruiting additional immigration judges so that they can crank up the hearings and determine whether or not people qualify for asylum.
So I'm sure you're both aware of the 2013 effort. There was a bipartisan reform bill that was put together that ultimately went nowhere, but it's often pointed to as an example of opportunities for bipartisan reform on legal immigration. I don't know if it touched on border security or national security, but I'm curious, how has the conversation changed since then? And are you seeing any similarities from the 2013 effort in terms of policy proposals and what the Biden administration is putting out there?
Yeah, I don't know that the conversation has changed an awful lot. It may have, through the Trump experience, gotten more difficult. That proposal did create a path for citizenship. And it was, in many ways, very progressive. And it did pass the United States Senate, but went nowhere in the House. Speaker Boehner was not willing to entertain the legislation. A number of the senators that voted for that proposal are no longer in the U.S. Senate, notably John McCain, one of the leaders. But there are a few who are still there, including Lindsey Graham, Senator Menendez from New Jersey, Senator Durbin from Illinois. So there is the possibility that it could be revived, but you got to keep your fingers crossed as to whether it's actually going to happen or not.
There was a grand bargain, you might say, of some sorts, in the sense that it did deal with border security. There was actually a huge amount of money. I think it was about $40 billion that was set aside in that bill for border security. And that was the idea that you'd have increased legal immigration, you'd have a pathway to citizenship, you'd do something about people that were already here, and you would at the same time invest in border security.
The grand bargain never worked, though.
Right. It did in the Senate. I mean, here's the thing, is that not to be forgotten or to be lamented anyways, it got 68 votes in the Senate. I mean, by modern standards, that's just enormous. So it's the system worked in the Senate the way it's supposed to, with bipartisan compromises to build towards some sort of large bill to deal with a real problem. And as George said, it just, you know, got killed in the House, not because there weren't the votes to pass it, but because the Speaker refused to bring it to the floor.
That's right.
Because he thought it would pass. And there were a lot of Republicans that were against it, but not all. There were a lot of Republicans that were for it. He didn't want to split the conference. You get these rules about, well, we don't want votes where you can't get unanimous support from our side. Well, that's just nonsense. That's a terrible way to do business. In this case, we missed a huge opportunity.
Missed a big opportunity. And as a result of that grand bargain, Obama still went forward and became known as the deporter in chief. He deported a 500,000 undocumented persons living in the United States, more than any other president in history, but it still wasn't enough to satisfy the hardliners. It could be different this time. Who knows? President Biden is trying to be a healer. He's trying to be bipartisan, trying to bring sides together. He has deep ties to the United States Senate. So I suppose, anything is possible.
I think we might leave the conversation there because it at least ends on a positive, hopeful note of maybe we'll see some bipartisan reform in this area, in this new Congress. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Ambassador and Immigration Attorney George Bruno and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby discuss immigration proposals and potential reforms. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Ambassador Bruno.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.